Facebook's policy, for instance, that they're not going to fact check or otherwise take down what elected leaders and candidate campaigns do and say in the course of paid advertisements, mean that things like, you know, Trump's invasion ads during the 2018 cycle stay up. That rhetoric, no matter how inflammatory, can get used to Trump's advantage.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. If you listen to this podcast, you know that I have a long interest in the intersection of computers and political campaigns. For me, it goes back to a paper I wrote on that subject for a fall 1986 class on political parties and elections that I took in college with Professor David Mayhew, and to the software company I founded in 1997, originally called NGP Software, Inc. Daniel Kreese is someone who shares that interest with me. He's an associate professor in the Hussman School of Journalism and Media at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he studies how technology has changed political campaigns over time. His two books on the subject, Taking Our Country Back, The Crafting of Network Politics from Howard Dean to Barack Obama, which tells about new media and democratic political campaigning in that period, and his follow-up entitled Prototype Politics, The Making and Unmaking of Technological Innovation in the Republican and Democratic Parties, 2000 to 2014, which talks about the role of digital media, data, and analytics in contemporary campaigning and compares the two parties. So Daniel and I had a very interesting conversation, and I hope you'll listen to it. So after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Professor Kreese at UNC Chapel Hill.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
My name is Daniel Kreese. I'm an associate professor in the Hussman School of Journalism and Media at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and one of the principal researchers behind the new UNC Center for Information Technology and Public Life. And much of my research career has been focused on how tech has changed political campaigns and charts broadly sort of the history of the field over the last two decades.
Which is not too far from my own personal interest over a career, so pretty excited to talk to you today. Would you just tell me a little bit about sort of the background that took you in this particular research direction? So where did you grow up and when did you first get interested in politics and technology? What was the sort of educational path and interest path?
I'm a product of New Jersey and New Jersey public schools. And in the course of, you know, just growing up, I came from a family that was very politically aware and one that had family members on both sides of the aisle of many different ideological stripes, so to speak. So, you know, my family gatherings were always quite animated, you know, discussing, debating political issues. I went to Bates College, which is a small private liberal arts school up in Maine, largely because I wanted to get as far away as from New Jersey as I could. And it was there that I studied political science and did a lot of work on newspaper and media coverage of sports and other figures with sort of an eye to their political valence. So how did journalists write about boxers such as Muhammad Ali and Sonny Liston and Floyd Patterson in ways that reflected their attitudes towards things like the civil rights movement? And, you know, after that, I moved to New York City and worked in various nonprofit management positions and some political positions, including for Citizen Action New York, which is a progressive organizing group. And it was there that I got involved with the Working Families Party during the 2001 mayoral primary, which also happened to happen on September 11th, 2001. So that was my political experience. We were organizing for Mark Green, who was the public advocate at the time, running against Michael Bloomberg back in 01. It was really there that I sort of had my first real, I would say, political experience and political interest. And it was very old school. You know, it was a lot of canvassing, door knocking, long Democratic club meetings in places like Brooklyn, poll watching, working with union organizations as they organize their members, many hour endorsement meetings with candidates. It was hyper local, hyper New York City focused, and very old tech, so to speak. Lots of telephones, you know, lots of in-person face-to-face meetings, lots of literature drops and the like. In the course of doing that work and 9/11 happening, I really sort of reflected on what it is that I was sort of most interested in doing. And one thing that was really missing from my life was writing. I really loved to write. I had, after 9/11, started some after-school programs for immigrant middle schoolers in Brooklyn. But I decided I want to go back to school to focus a little bit more on writing, which took me to Stanford University. I went out there to do a master's degree in 2003. And that was right in the middle of the 2003-2004 presidential primaries, you know, Howard Dean's big tech-fueled run. And I became really just interested in what it seemed like was a very new way of organizing and engaging in politics and new technologies empowering citizens to get involved in ways that we had never seen before. And as I was, you know, writing about this from a journalistic perspective, I knew that I had to see it. Kind of on a whim, in the middle of the night, I connected with some Bay Area volunteers for Howard Dean, and I flew to Lincoln, Nebraska, and drove a couple hours to Sioux City, Iowa, and followed around a group of Dean volunteers for a couple days before the caucuses in Iowa, just watching the ways that they use technology to connect people in new ways, and how is that being combined with the old school face-to-face stuff that I had done before, and what did that all mean for democracy? What did it mean for citizenship? What did it mean for participation? What did it mean for social solidarity? All those questions were really spinning around in my head. And I got so enthralled with those questions that I never left Stanford. Well, it took me another 5 years to leave, but I stayed to do a PhD. And that dissertation became the subject in my first book, Taking Our Country Back, The Crafting of Network Politics from Howard Dean to Barack Obama. And in that book, really what I did was trace the origins and development of the Dean campaign, and then the travel of a bunch of alumni from that Dean campaign to influential sites in Democratic politics, including the Democratic Party, and, you know, in firms like Blue State Digital, and watch the ways in which they transformed what it meant to engage in Democratic campaigning and ended up helping to elect the first African-American president in 2008.
What was the reception of that book? Who read it and what did it lead to for you?
It's a book that had two primary audiences. I mean, one was an audience of academics and undergraduates who read it, graduate students who read it. Because what I wanted to do in that book was tell a new type of history. Lots of people told histories of presidential campaign cycles, and they told histories of presidential candidates and obviously presidents. But no one really before that book came out had told a history from the tech perspective, right? What did it mean that the tools that you know Howard Dean picked up were being developed behind the scenes at the Democratic Party and rolled out for the Obama campaign in 2008? What did it mean that new tech like databases and database interfaces like those provided by NGP Van, Party Builder, and then Vote Builder, what did it mean that those things were developing and becoming more sophisticated and helping candidates find voters and helping volunteers serve electoral efforts from the comfort of their own homes. Nobody had ever told a history like that before. So I really I wanted to reach out to the research community and sort of show that like this is really important stuff. We tend to think about politics only in terms of candidates and in terms of campaigns and in terms of, you know, media and advertising and broadcasting. But I really wanted to make the case that like the tools that underlie all this stuff are really important because they shape the ways not only that candidates run, but they shape the ways that citizens can be citizens and whose voices can be heard and what they can say. And then I would say, like, within the practitioner community itself, there were a lot of folks who saw themselves in this history, who saw, you know, themselves playing a key role in developing the models and the tech and the tools for Barack Obama's run. Part of it, too, was folks who were at the Democratic Party in that time or for firms and organizations that, you know, were sort of working in between the election cycles, far away from, you know, the spotlight, who really saw, I think, their work validated in various ways, that like all that hard work of like data integration and building systems, you know, that happens after the press is long gone is the stuff that actually really matters for electoral success a couple years down the road.
You asked a couple times, what did it mean? You know, all of this development, this change, this kind of revolution in tech and politics, what did it mean? What are your main conclusions?
I'll sort of say that by telling a bit of a, I guess, a bigger historical story, right? Which is, we've had a couple of, I would say, big eras that sort of characterize the texture of politics. The first was really the labor-intensive era. That's the era of strong party politics. In that world, what you saw was very strong political party organizations, lots of ways that social affiliation were often the motivators for people voting, as well as who they voted for. You know, the big torchlight parades during the 1800s, the ways that, you know, being a member of a party meant dressing up and parading through the streets and drinking with other men. And they were men at the time who were going to vote, but really dominated by a style of organization and labor that were provided by very strong political parties themselves. Over the course of the 20th century, the power of political parties diminished. And we entered a new era, which scholars call the capital-intensive era of politics. And this is really the, from the 1940s on, the version of politics that is fought through what used to be known as air wars, right? Mass communication campaigns, large-scale advertising that was designed to try to persuade the electorate and turn them out to vote. What that left us with was largely a citizenship of spectators. Gone were the days of the torchlight parades. Now people were engaging in politics from their couches while they were passive and watching electoral appeals on television. And it got so bad that even as recently as the 1990s, presidential campaigns were turning away volunteers because they didn't know what to do with them. Their model of campaigning and their model of citizenship was one that was built around a television screen and really expensive consultants who were running, you know, ads that were targeting the electorate. So much so that, you know, the flesh and blood aspect of politics, the person-to-person aspect of politics had, you know, looked like it was going to just kind of wither away. And that's when we entered an era of politics that I call in my second book, Prototype Politics, the technology-intensive era of politics. And there are a couple key hallmarks of that new era, which was largely fueled by the internet and a set of associated technologies. One, it was much more premised on active, not passive citizenship. Now, there were still things, of course, like online political advertising you see, right, that growing by leaps and bounds. But the politics of a lot of the internet and technology intensive era was about social connection. It was about citizens doing things like giving small dollar donations to the candidates of their choice, which enabled campaigns like that of Barack Obama's to compete on a level playing field with a candidate like Hillary Clinton in 2008, who had massive amounts of institutional resources and support. Obama, fueled by small donations, could keep pace with that. You saw citizens taking politics back into their own hands in new and really important ways. So a lot of the early electoral technologies, whether it was Dean on, you know, using Meetup to help organize supporters and supporters organizing themselves, whether it was the Obama campaign in 2008 using mybarackobama.com in order to have volunteers go out there and make phone calls and plan events. The thing is, people were driving a lot of that themselves. Campaigns were also participants in that, but you can organize now at scale really large events that could potentially touch hundreds of people, if not thousands of people. I was a precinct captain in the course of my research for Barack Obama in the mission in San Francisco back in 2007 and 2008. And we used all sorts of technologies from Vote Builder to the mybarackobama.com to various Excel spreadsheets and calling from internet voice connected apps in order to make phone calls. We combined the old school canvassing of the door to door with new school ways of reaching out to people and planning visibility events and raising money online and organizing ourselves. The old canvassing experiences I had in New York City, you know, I was just replicating online when I was a virtual precinct captain for the Obama campaign in 08 in Laredo, Texas, where I had my own precinct, but it was all online. It was all digital. It was making calls in advance of that primary to other Democrats. You know, if I had to point to one big thing, it was just the increased citizen engagement in democratic processes themselves, which has really come about with the technology-intensive era. And all of this, all the examples that I just mentioned to you, was also all pre-social media. From 2008 on, you've just seen an explosion in things like YouTube and Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, all of which has meant that now what's really important are social flows of political communication. It's citizens having conversations with other citizens. It's citizens passing along information, sometimes dubious, to other citizens. It's social networks now being a very key channel for political communication in all sorts of new and important ways where campaigns can try to harness them and guide them and steer them. But it's also an important way that citizens have power to shape what the tenure of conversation is like in a democracy, in both good and bad ways, to be honest.
Prototype politics is sort of, in a lot of ways, a continuation of your first book, right?
Yeah, it was kind of the sequel. So I did two things. I brought Prototype Politics up to date. The first book stopped in 2008. Prototype Politics went through 2014. And then the other thing that I tried to do in Prototype Politics was bring in the Republican Party too. The first book, Taking Our Country Back, was exclusively focused on Democrats, really in terms of telling the key history. Prototype Politics gave the Republican Party the same historical focus as the previous one did on Democrats.
Didn't you, in the second one, study the tech staff that were on both sides and found some significant differences?
Yeah. So we found all sorts of really interesting things. I guess a couple of the key highlights. So one of the big stories, at least in the research literature and in a lot of public discourse, were the ways in which politics was very much dominated by professionals. In that capital intensive era that I talked about earlier, all you needed was a good pollster, someone who would, you know, just went cycle to cycle, up and down ballot, you know, plying his or her wares about what the state of the electorate is like. And you needed communications professionals and professionals who were cost a lot of money to cut you that 30-second television ad spot. One of the things that I set out to do was to test whether that was true in this new world of tech, which in the book I took to be four new, very new areas on campaigning. So it's technology, so people who do IT. It's digital media, which has changed in nomenclature over the years. But, you know, digital used to be new media, used to be internet, used to be all sorts of things. Now it's digital. And that includes social media now. Data, which grew as a much more extensive and developed practice since the 1990s, and that includes the large data warehouses that both parties and outside organizations maintain on every member of the electorate. And then analytics, right? So it's that specialized group of people who figure out how do we make data meaningful in a way that we can figure out what it is that we want to say and how it is that we're going to say it and how do we get people's attention and craft the most persuasive messages use for electoral gain. We looked at a few things. We looked at, how much were campaigns on both sides of the aisle investing in this new world of tech? And we charted differences by campaign. We also charted differences by party over time. And the big takeaway there was through the 2012 cycles that Democrats were investing a lot more in tech, in digital, in data, and in analytics. And we could talk about sort of why that was the case during that particular time. The other important thing that we found is that in contrast to this story of professionalism, that it turns out that there's like a lot of churn in the people who work in politics. We found that campaigns were deliberately looking to hire people from places like Silicon Valley, from the worlds of commercial tech more broadly in hubs like Boston and Chicago. We found that people, you know, went into and out of politics, which with far greater frequency than any research had sort of suggested before, that, you know, people would take a leave of absence, for instance. Very famously on Google, you at one point in the past, you could have a year sabbatical to go work on a project that you wanted to work on. And people went there to go work for like the Obama reelect in 2012. So people were constantly hopping into politics and out of politics. The other thing that we found was very high rates of entrepreneurship. People who worked on presidential campaigns often looked to commercialize some of the technologies that were coming out of them and would start new firms in really big and really important ways. There was a lot more entrepreneurship on the Democratic side of the aisle than the Republican part of the aisle. In subsequent studies, we found that campaigns that had the most diverse mix of people who came from different worlds, people who cross from many different sectors into politics, tended to be the ones that were the most innovative, to pursue the groundbreaking tech that was sort of new to a cycle. And we also sort of more broadly, I think, sort of convened around this idea that labor was just a lot more flexible in this new world, and then it gave Democrats an advantage during that particular time when, on full display to my eyes, a big example of that would be, Mitt Romney's campaign versus Barack Obama's campaign in 2012. We're on the Obama side. Not only did you have a very diverse team and a massive team, people who were coming from all sorts of places, and including Silicon Valley, working on tools. He also had an advantage of incumbency, which is that he could run for 2 years and build new tools and build new applications. Meanwhile, on the Republican side of the aisle, after years of underinvestment and a competitive primary, Mitt Romney had Project Orca, right? Which very spectacularly and very sort of famously failed on election day. And I think it was like really captured in that particular moment between the two campaigns about how and why all this stuff really matters for when it comes time to vote.
Since you published Prototype Politics in 2016, what have you seen happening?
So the one thing that I didn't anticipate, and I don't think anybody did, and I'll sort of say this through the lens of probably the big thing that I myself missed and a lot of other people missed, which is the growth and increasing centrality of platform companies to everything Democratic. Here's an illustration of this, right? So in 2012, you still had a world where the Obama team was building very big in-house tools. They were building very large digital teams and advertising teams to sort of execute online advertising. They had a very deep bench of resources and expertise and knowledge more broadly. Fast forward 4 years, and it's increasingly the platforms themselves that become the source of expertise and knowledge in things like the political advertising space online. Let me give you an example of this. So one of the follow-up studies that I did, it wasn't a book. It was an academic paper, the first one to study the embeds from social media firms into the Trump campaign in 2016 in a systematic way. But one of the things that always struck us with a lot of curiosity in the wake of 2016 was the fact that, I have this massive data set on every staffer who's worked in tech, digital data and analytics from 2004 to 2016. It's over 1,000 staffers. We have their complete career histories, et cetera. And what was really striking to us in the months after the 2016 election was just how few staffers Donald Trump had, like 4 or 5 on the tech side. And of course, people at the RNC sort of helped him do stuff, et cetera. And that really sort of got us thinking is like, you know, Hillary Clinton had over 300 people working on digital alone. Donald Trump had about 4 everywhere. What's going on with this? How did the Trump campaign pull off these massive Facebook advertising campaigns? And how did they end up creating the content that they did, et cetera? How did they, you know, have the efficient data and targeting and analytics operations to best what was a far superior Hillary Clinton campaign, at least on paper? And that led us to the platforms and led us really looking into the ways in which Team Trump outsourced a lot of the knowledge and expertise they needed directly to Facebook and directly to Google, so that these companies were basically providing the Trump team with the knowledge infrastructure that it needed in order to contest the campaign. So now there's been a lot more reporting to come out since we've published that initial piece. But the campaign, you know, rented out an office, a strip mall down in Texas, and a lot of the major tech platforms moved staff down there to help them execute the couple $100 million digital advertising buys. They did a lot of the testing for them because they wanted them to spend more money. It was, you know, the account services that they would offer to any big digital ad spender. It just so happened to be a presidential candidate. In that world, what became very striking, I think, to me, having been studying this for a long time, is that it really suggested the centrality of platform companies in providing the infrastructure for all democratic politics, but doing so in ways that not only they weren't only conduits of political information, they actually actively shaped what campaigns themselves do. And, you know, we showed a lot of examples of this, but, you know, it wasn't just about helping the Team Trump optimize their digital advertising, advising on things like targeting strategies, advising on things like engaging strategies, optimizing ads. It also went down to, like, you know, them providing advice to the Trump team about its organic content that they were posting on platforms like Facebook, and how they were populating the Google search page and the organic content they had there, or how to use Facebook Live and the like. That they were really, you know, the companies themselves are now playing this digital consulting role in really important ways. And I think in ways that undoubtedly helped Trump, who didn't have anywhere near the same resources as the Hillary Clinton team did in 2016 to execute a modern campaign. And I think that was really key to the story. You know, that was the part that I was most involved in studying, just given my own background. But, you know, you saw lots of other research that comes out about that election, just the sweeping vulnerabilities of all the major platform companies when it came to, you know, ensuring that advertisers were complying with election laws, that there was no verification systems in place to ensure that those who were buying political ads were actually able to do so under the law, that they were U.S. Organizations and U.S. citizens. You saw massive vulnerabilities with respect to foreign strategic communication on those platforms designed to undermine the American election. You saw zero transparency and accountability. There were no ad transparency databases back in 2016. There was no way for third parties to see the spectrum of political communication that was paid for, that was out there. There was no way for people to fact check it. So just the massive vulnerabilities in the platforms, frankly, became vulnerabilities in our own democracy during that cycle.
Very stark and frankly, pretty scary to me in a lot of ways. When you look forward to the very quickly approaching 2020 election, what state do you put our democracy in through this sort of lens?
It's hard to be an optimist at this point in American history. So I'll approach this from the perspective of a social scientist and say that there are clearly some things that we're doing better from an elections perspective, from a democratic small d perspective. And there are still a lot of things that we don't have answers to. So in the world of platform companies, I think one important thing has been the real progress that has been made by all the major platform companies. And here I'm thinking about, you know, Facebook and Instagram. I'm thinking about Google. I'm thinking about Twitter, you know, Snapchat, the ways in which that they've become much more active regulators of their own platforms when it comes to things like complying with U.S. election law and building in greater transparency and public disclosure around paid political communication. So just a few examples of that, all the major platforms now in place have verification requirements for political advertisers that require those who are buying ads to be able to do so under existing U.S. law. All the major platforms now have really important ad transparency databases where third parties like journalists can actually go and see the advertising that's being bought and paid for and targeted to the American public. I think those two are good things. I think the third area that we've seen vast improvements are with respect to election security. Now, by no means is any of this fail-safe, but it's on the radar of platforms in ways that it wasn't before, where they're thinking about what is, you know, strategic and foreign manipulation look like. What does, you know, coordinated inauthentic behavior that sort of uses technical and other means to try to manipulate public discourse? What does that look like now? Trying to be proactive about taking these campaigns down and stopping them before they occur. I think we're much farther advanced in 2016 than we were before it. That's to be commended. Where have we not made a ton of progress? I think on a number of different levels, and largely because I think these problems are really hard. You even see this now around the COVID crisis, which is the relationship between platforms and content moderation is still unsettled and unclear. There are a lot of differences across platforms in terms of how they'll treat various actors, whether they're world leaders or average citizens. You saw this with the Lincoln Project's paid advertisement around Morning in America when Facebook made a decision to take it down, all because of one fact check that said that it contained partly false information, which was the only middle category that Facebook made available. There was no partly true, for instance, and they decided to take this down, which benefits the president, because the president and any other candidate can run whatever ad they want to run because they're not subject to fact checking, but outside groups are. We see this though across the board. It's not just Facebook. You know, Twitter made their famous decision to ban all political advertising whatsoever. And in my opinion, that was a misguided decision for one important reason, is that it benefits people like Donald Trump, who never need to spend a dollar on Twitter to get their message out, and hurts candidates like Joe Biden, who have a fraction of the reach that Donald Trump has. And to put it in broader terms outside of the presidential race, it benefits incumbents with large, already well-established constituencies over challengers, who often have to scrape by to start to build a following. And one of the ways that they do so is through political advertising. But you see differences in how platforms have approached all these questions. I think it makes for a very confusing environment. I think it makes for an environment where it's very difficult to hold platforms accountable for the decisions that they do make. I think it makes it challenging, too, for political professionals to figure out how do we navigate this world in a way to run a campaign the way that we want to run a campaign. We still lack a lot when it comes to things like public transparency and public disclosure. So those ad transparency databases that I mentioned earlier, they're really hard to work with. They're very difficult to extract meaningful information from. In a world where you're running, you know, hundreds of different ads to test performance, journalists have to wade through hundreds of different ads to find the ones that are qualitatively different. So it's sort of an inundation of information, often makes it harder to find the signal within sort of a lot of noise. You know, I guess I'll sort of add too, is that we also lack a lot when it comes to things like transparency and disclosure, particularly from platforms in a lot of other ways as well. The platform companies have still been not very transparent when it comes to providing data on what we actually see with respect to political communication. Facebook has tried some new initiatives. They've been really frustrating to work with. The data has been very frustrating to work with, in some cases not forthcoming. In some cases, it ends up being radically different than what we expected it would be. I would say that broadly, we lack a lot of transparency on things that are actually like really important to know, things like targeting strategy, things like data privacy and data security, not only from platforms, but from campaigns themselves, all of which I think leaves the U.S. electoral system vulnerable.
I'm certain that you read an article in the Times, an opinion piece by Thomas Edsall about Trump is staking out his own universe of alternative facts, quotes you in the article. You had talked about how campaigns had sort of moved onto the platforms more than trying to create their own social networks. But here we have the Trump campaign putting out a fair amount of technology and, according to this article, trying to keep their most devoted supporters in kind of their own echo chamber and talking to each other as a technique for mobilizing them and organizing them. What do you see going on there, and how well do you think that might work?
My perspective on what the Trump campaign has tried to do is one that it's both a continuation of a lot of older campaign tactics where you want to keep people enthused and engaged and sort of within their own circle of enthusiasm, within their own identity groups to keep them motivated, et cetera. But at the same time, I think what's really changed in around the Trump campaign over the last decade has been the right-wing media universe that has largely created self-reinforcing narratives and self-reinforcing identities that the Trump team has really benefited from. So I guess what I would say first on sort of what the Trump campaign is doing, you know, where they're gamifying certain platforms to help increase electoral engagement around the Trump team. I mean, a lot of it looks similar to other technologies that had been used in previous cycles that has looked to create certain things as well, right? Create your own, in essence, social network in and around a particular campaign. You know, mybarackobama.com had gamified elements. They had social elements. It was done to, you know, mobilize and create collective identity among supporters. The blog was written for people to create a real narrative and a sense of identity to keep people, you know, doing the hard work that the campaign needed to be done. You know, a lot of that messaging was very much about creating and fostering a movement in a way that I think the Trump team is sort of also building on and emulating in various ways. Where I would disagree with people who sort of say that, like, that's such a self-referential community is that, to me, that world that the Trump team is trying to build around the campaign is still embedded in a larger right-wing media ecosystem that has largely turned away from mainstream professional journalism and has carved out a world of information and identity around sites like Fox, around Breitbart, and around a, you know, interlinked networks of various YouTube channels and civil society and advocacy groups like the NRA, all of which create a coherent narrative and a worldview that those people who are using Trump's digital tools are also participating in every day. To my eyes, it's really a coherent network of right-wing media that serves to do things like protect the president from critique, to mobilize people, to create collective identity and solidarity, to build faith and investment in the president, to attack critics, to give people a set of narratives that they could use in their own lives to refute arguments from the other side, or that they can carry with them as they look to reach out to others. I wouldn't necessarily disagree that the Trump team has built tools to create these self-referential networks. But what I would say is that they're also part and parcel of a much wider media ecosystem that the right has spent 20 years developing, and that has looked to create sort of a very sort of seamless narrative community that has proven very electorally effective.
And is really amazingly connected to a president who, more than anyone I can remember, tries to create his own reality or unreality, you know, and connects to that world and responds to it and alters it. This is a development in our politics that's gigantic, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. This is one of the places where I have sympathy for platform companies. Everyone sort of clamors for platform companies to, you know, take a greater role in content moderation and the like, but they're really hamstrung when you have misinformation and even disinformation coming from the top, coming from those offices and those institutions that we rely on in a democracy to provide us with nonpartisan, reliable information upon which we can make decisions in every areas of our life, from health to our economic well-being. As those institutionally produced sources of knowledge get undermined, as they get delegitimated, as the authoritative sources for things like information start to wither away, in part through a continual assault by the president and others who have sought to delegitimize them, that leaves us in very unprecedented territory. You see that everywhere. I mean, you look and you see just the ways in which things like mask wearing is now a partisan badge for the differentially from the right and the left. It's no longer a health issue. To see that the fundamental disconnects in people's empirical understandings of things like the state of the economy, or the state of the COVID crisis and the ways that that's now filtered through a partisan lens is also a very real indication that this is something that's happening. And I think most social scientists would agree that everyone engages in motivated reasoning. Partisanship shapes everyone's perception of empirical reality in the world. I think a key differentiator is that, as we know from the work of people like Yochai Benkler and others, that on the left, there is still much greater trust in things like professional journalism and scientific institutions than there is on the right. As motivated as the left might be to create their own empirical reality, there still are strong ties and strong trust in institutionally produced knowledge. And that has been something that has disappeared on the right. And I think that's what's dangerous about it.
Well, we go into the fall with some of the Democratic strategies probably off the table, like door-to-door canvassing, with a Trump campaign that's had a lot longer to build up following, you know, on Twitter, on Facebook, all these things, with his success in cultivating his base. Like that article I referenced had the kind of eye-catching statistic from a survey that church attending white Protestants, now half of them believe that Trump was anointed by God to be president, and a big difference in the tech infrastructures between Biden and Trump. When you consider all those things, which party do you think is advantaged by the unique situation we are in?
Oh, I think no doubt it's the Republicans. I mean, let me unpack a few things that you sort of said here. So one is something that I spent a lot of time writing about in Prototype Politics, which is that idea of a technical advantage of incumbency, which is a really just fancy way of saying an incumbent has a much longer runway in order to campaign and electioneer. That means additional years and months to develop a big database of supporters, to test messaging, to figuring out like what's the most persuasive and what's not, what's going to move people to vote and what's not, to raise money. All those things take time to build. And Donald Trump has a massive advantage over Joe Biden in that category alone, because, you know, heading into the general election, Biden ran a very underfinanced campaign. He didn't have a huge tech or digital team. He was not able to access party resources anywhere near as early as Trump was. So, you know, he's kind of limping now to the general election, being a year behind where the president is. And I think you see this just across the board when it comes to things like digital advertising, when it comes to organic assets, you know, just how many followers you have, when it comes to things like Trump's ability to set the agenda and the frames for the entire media, right? What are people talking about? They're talking about what Trump wants them to talk about. And that's a unique power that the president has by virtue of his office, but also by virtue of who this president is uniquely. I think they've been very effective at sort of wielding that. The second thing that you point to, and I think that this is really important and something that doesn't get talked about anywhere near enough, is that the two parties are very different in terms of their coalitions. So a lot of very recent political science, I'll pitch a book called Uncivil Agreement by Liliana Mason, which is a brilliant book that shows how the two U.S. political parties now represent very different groups in the electorate. On the Republican side of the aisle, it tends to be voters who are more religious, people who live in rural areas, white voters, for instance. On the Democratic side, it tends to be people who are more secular, who are more urban, and it's a much more multi-ethnic and diverse coalition. What Republicans can utilize to their advantage and have utilized to their advantage over the last few election cycles in particular is a very strong network of faith, particularly evangelical and Protestant churches, that can always be relied upon to serve as information networks for their congregants, for their congregations. And that's particularly important in a time when trust is declining in all sorts of social institutions. Faith-based trust remains strong and remains important to the extent that Trump and Republicans can tap into this other network of information that exists outside of politics, but that's very important to politics. I think they absolutely have an advantage. And I think that you've seen, you know, the Trump team to invest very early on in this strategy of cultivating evangelical leaders and cultivating evangelical networks across the board, as well as, you know, Protestants and people in faith on the right, particularly whites, and have leveraged that for support of the president to validate the president and create alternative networks of trust.
A lot of your work seems pretty predicated on the idea that campaigns matter, and that's not always shared that notion by political science more broadly. Is all this stuff that's going on going to be a big deal and make a difference? Or are the kind of fundamental variables of a recession, a pandemic, a congealed view about the president based on his kind of communication style over time, is this going to be a referendum on him more broadly? And a lot of this stuff maybe just matters on the margin.
Yeah, so this is a great question, and one that, you know, as you know, like political scientists have been debating this for years. I'll give you my perspective on this, right? There are absolutely important fundamental drivers of elections that candidates can't affect or have a direct way of affecting, right, in important ways in election year. So one is the economy, right, and the foundations of the economy and its performance. Another is partisanship, right? What does the electorate look like that those two general election candidates are inheriting when they start to run for office? A third is incumbency, right? So we know, for instance, that it would have been really difficult for Hillary Clinton to essentially win a third term for her political party, just given the ways that the American electorate had voted historically. So those are all sort of the ground basis that make up those so-called fundamentals that are important drivers of the election. But what I think is really key here is that candidates need to play the hands that they're dealt. The economy and the performance of the economy only matters to the extent that it still becomes a campaign issue for people. Trump has to message on the economy and Biden has to message on the economy. Partisanship is another important variable, right? So where every candidate inherits a landscape, an electoral landscape made up of a certain number of Republicans and a certain number of Democrats. And we know, for instance, that 90% of Republicans will vote with Republicans and 90% of Democrats will vote with Democrats. However, one of the important things that campaigns do is mobilize people to vote. How do we actually pull people out to the polls? And that's a communication process and that's a campaign process. Trump needs to engage evangelicals, for instance, to get them excited about the election and get them to be wanting to vote. That's something that campaigns do. So the structural fact of how many Republicans exist out there and how many Democrats exist out there is not important on its own. It's the groundwork upon which a campaign is built. And that's where campaigns, I think, really matter. And that's where I think all this stuff really matters. So to give you some examples of where I think campaigns will particularly matter during this election is that it's an unprecedented crisis. So what the campaigns will be doing is engaging in a debate. And I think this is even playing out now, which is, what was the nature of Trump's leadership during this crisis? Was it good leadership, or did it result in more people dying than was necessary? How do we interpret that in a way that becomes salient or meaningful for voters? Same thing with the economy, right? Trump will have to try to make an argument that's persuasive, not only to his own party and to independents, but also to Democrats, that says that the economy was having unprecedented success heading into this year, and then we had an unprecedented crisis, but we'll bounce back. And Biden needs to craft a counter argument about that. And another one, and I mean, I think a lot of political scientists point to the 2016 election as being not just about the economy and not just about incumbency, but very explicitly, it was Trump's racial appeals to whites. It was making white identity salient and politically actionable and tied to a political choice at the polls in the Republican Party that was a very key driver of that election. And that's a campaign effect. Right? The ways that Trump and Biden are going to assemble their coalitions by saying, this is who I am going to represent, this is what my party stands for, ultimately can become consequential at the polls. And those are all things that campaigns do. So once we start from that premise, then we start to see that where campaigns really matter is by conveying this messaging, conveying this communication, conveying these ideas through many different channels, whether that's door to door, which is likely not going to happen this election cycle, but then it's going to be on Facebook, right? Or it's going to be in a digital ad alongside an ad on YouTube TV. Might be a radio ad through old school radio that's then complemented by ads that run on a different social media platform like Spotify. All of those things then become really important and consequential for how campaigns actually get their story and their narrative of an election out and make it meaningful. As the UCLA political scientist Lynn Vavreck put it, right, candidates don't create the cards, but they play the hand that they're dealt. And that's where campaigns really come in an important way.
You can see some of the ways very transparently, some of the ways that Trump is trying to shape that narrative, the switch from keep America great to transition to greatness, the preparing to kind of put China on the table as a big campaign boogeyman, the way he did with the people coming up from the South America, Central America in the midterms, how Comey may have probably made the difference in 2016. How does the kind of what you're observing in the intersection of tech and politics and the platforms and the, how does that play into sort of all of those things that happen in the fall? How does it all connect together?
Yeah. So I think every example that you just mentioned, the quote unquote immigrant caravan during the 2018 cycle, you know, the messaging around China during this cycle currently, the broader framing of the election as being about us versus a shadowy them. All of this plays out not just in the president's speeches, but through things like paid advertisements, through organic posts on Twitter, through tweets, through driving the whole media ecosystem, including what shows up on Sean Hannity and Fox News. So all this becomes a basic foundational part of the politics of distinction. That broad set of social divisions that Trump is going to try to create to assemble a winning electoral coalition. And you do that through any means that you have available if you're a campaign, right? And where I think it really matters is that, you know, we've seen lots of debates over the over this, but Facebook's policy, for instance, that they're not going to fact check or otherwise take down what elected leaders and candidate campaigns do and say in the course of paid advertisements, mean that things like, you know, Trump's invasion ads during the 2018 cycle stay up. That rhetoric, no matter how inflammatory, can get used to Trump's advantage. It means that when Trump tries to make a broad-based, let's say, appeal about China, being the source of COVID and undermining the health of U.S. citizens. It means that people can't pay on Twitter to run ads to counter that messaging, because there's no other way anyone else is going to be able to generate the millions upon millions of supporters and followers that Trump has on Twitter. So all these policies become really consequential in important ways. And again, that's not to make, we can have a separate conversation about what Facebook's and Twitter's policy should be. But the point is that these private companies provide democratic infrastructures in new and unprecedented ways. Every one of their policies, down from content moderation to the ways that they treat political micro-targeting differently from commercial micro-targeting, all has potential electoral effects. And I think we're only in the early stages of beginning to fully understand them.
You're associated with a couple of different institutions, and I'm sure you're working on a bunch of stuff that, you know, just your research and your writing. What are the main things that you're up to these days?
I kind of have two separate lines of research. One, I'm super happy to announce that we have a book coming out this summer with Oxford University Press called Recoding the Boys Club. And it's the first look at the experiences of women working in political technology. It was written with me and six other co-authors, all women, graduate students and undergraduate students who've worked with me for years on a project where we analyzed things like hiring patterns of women in political tech. We analyzed the degree to which women achieve leadership positions in political tech, their rates of entrepreneurship vis-a-vis men. And we interviewed 45 women active on 12 different presidential campaigns to get a sense of their experiences and what barriers did they face within the campaign organizations that they worked on, particularly through the lens of some very high profile cases of things like sexual harassment, sexual assault, unequal pay on very prominent presidential bids. You know, I'm super proud of that project. The second author on the piece, Kirsten Adams, will be sort of out there talking a lot more about it. But it really shows how much farther the field has to go when it comes to creating more equitable environments and why that really matters. It matters for the types of people who do the work. It matters for the performance of campaigns. And it matters for democracy that, you know, campaigns should represent the people their candidates are striving to represent. So it's a story of equity and it's a story of inclusion. I have a long-running research program through the Center for Information Technology and Public Life, and my various research assistants and researchers who are there, most notably Bridget Barrett, who has been a lead digital politics research with me. We look into the questions of the role that platforms play in democracy. And we've really started with their political advertising policies. So we issued a couple of reports over the past year that provided the first side-by-side comparative analyses of the different rules platforms have over things like micro-targeting in the political space, and has showed the massive differences even behind like what Facebook versus Google defines as a political ad and all the downstream consequences that potentially has. We also have done analyses of things like analyzing the ad transparency databases, making recommendations about how they can be improved so that they'd be a stronger tool for election transparency and the like. We just issued a report that then provided a systematic comparative analysis of the content moderation policies of all the major platforms and the ways that they treat different actors like world leaders differently from average users, and trying to figure out when are they going to step in and when are they not. I think we're now expanding that to start to look at enforcement. So how does enforcement look different across various platforms? How do they enforce content moderation problems or problematic content? Is that enforcement effective? What can be done differently about it? Finally, I have some various other projects working with various collaborators on things like misinformation and disinformation during campaigns, particularly in political advertising, but also by campaigns themselves. Which has really sort of been the focus of what does creative content on campaigns look like, what's potentially problematic with it, and how do we create a stronger, more robust democracy is sort of really driving all of these research questions.
I get the sense that you've put yourself in a place that you enjoy and want to be.
Yes, I will say, I mean, just a shout out, I love being at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm a strong believer in public education and public research universities, just the role that they play in social mobility and bringing together kids from all walks of life, of many different ideological persuasions, of different races and ethnicities and classes. I've just been over the moon at my experiences here. Just the ability to have difficult conversations across many different persuasions with people of many different backgrounds. It's been really enlightening, and it's unlike an environment that I've ever encountered anywhere else. So I've been super happy here, and I'm just really thankful for all the students that I've had the opportunity to work with over the last 10 years and hopefully for another 10.
You think you'll have students in person this fall?
According to UNC, absolutely. We are planning on starting in early August. So they've moved this semester up. They're going to try to finish it by Thanksgiving. And the classes will be smaller, and there'll probably be some mix of online and in-person. But that's the plan.
For practitioners in American politics, who are a few political scientists that they ought to be reading?
We live in such a golden age for research and scholarship to get beyond the ivory tower and inform the ways that citizens think about politics. So you have some really great venues that I would point to first, but you know, places like the Monkey Cage at the Washington Post, which a lot of political scientists actively write for, which looks to translate research and apply it to contemporary social problems. The important voices, I mean, people like Julia Azari, who often writes for the Monkey Cage and does lots of other public writing, I think is really insightful when it comes to things like parties and partisanship in the American presidency. Brendan Nyhan at Dartmouth has done amazing work on things like mis and disinformation. My colleague Emily Thorson at Syracuse has done amazing work and has a book coming out in the next year that looks at correcting misinformation and the politics of that. My center colleagues here, Dean Freelon, who does lots of work and has been issuing a lot of work now looking at ways in which Russian interests target African-Americans in particular through disinformation campaigns and at various identity-based campaigns. My colleague Alice Marwick does a lot of brilliant work on online right-wing radicalization. There's a broader network of centers. Kate Starbird at the University of Washington, Joan Donovan, Dana Boyd at Data and Society. People who are doing, I think, really just brilliant work trying to flesh out this intersection of media and tech and political dynamics. And then, of course, I mean, I think, you know, I loved the John Sides and Lynn Vavreck and Michael Tesler book about the 2016 election. It's called Identity Crisis. I think it was the most powerful piece of political science writing that explained a lot of pieces of that cycle. And then I would point to, you know, like Catherine Kramer's work, The Politics of Resentment, as being another really important voice in this space in terms of understanding what's driving politics today.
It's really been an honor to talk to you. I'd love to spend more time, but I think I've presumed enough. Is there a question that I didn't ask that you wish I had?
The only thing I would say going forward is that and I don't have an answer to it, so I probably would have just punted it anyway, but it's that question of like, where do we go from here, right? How do we create some sort of unifying American identity in an age of extreme partisanship that, you know, takes us away from undermining all the democratic institutions and the democratic norms that's essential to the functioning of this country. I see us moving in a very dangerous direction, in a very pre-Civil War direction when it comes to questioning the legitimacy of elections and questioning the good faith of the other side across partisan bounds. I think we're at a real inflection point, and we all need, I think every one of us, needs to be trying to think of ways that we get ourselves out of the path that we're on.
Boy, I couldn't agree more.
That was Daniel Kreiss. He's at Daniel Kreiss, K-R-E-I-S-S.com. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.